Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of truly uncommon intelligence who has brought it to bear in the most impressive way, namely by rigorously analyzing this war for the free world and helping to identify who are the combatants in it, the kind of warfare they're waging against us, and what we must do to protect ourselves and the rest of the freedom-loving peoples on this planet against what the tyrants of various kinds have in mind for all of us. His name is Ken Abramowitz. He is the founder and, well, driving force behind a wonderful public service. It's called SaveTheWest.com, and it is chock-a-block with information and analyses, diagrams, and other insights. And we're just going to give you a small taste of, well, the genius behind all that work in three discrete segments. One 5 minutes long, one 2 minutes long, and one 1 minute long, which Ken Abramowitz has honed into highly both informative and impactful messages with whom he shares his insights across this country with all kinds of political figures and others, including the public at large, who need to know what we're facing in this war for the free world. Ken Abramowitz, it's terrific to have you with us. Thank you for bringing this work with you and sharing it with our audience, and we're excited to have you give us a taste of the distilled essence of your thinking in these three increments, starting with a 5 minute one. Let's hear what you have to say.
Pleasure to be with you today.
So I want to get the 5 minute version. Give me the short course, as I say, on the fate of the free world as you see it. What are we up against and how's it going?
In 5 minutes, I'm going to give you a quick update of everything that's wrong in the world and how to fix it. First question, a rhetorical question, are we in peacetime or wartime? If you interview 10 people on the street at random, they'll tell you we're in peacetime, but we're in wartime. And we're in wartime because our enemies declared war on us, not because we declared war on them. So if our enemies declared war on us, we're in a state of war by definition. So what we're in now is World War III. And the question is, who's fighting who? The short answer is everyone's fighting everyone. It actually is a world war. World War I was basically Christians fighting Christians in Europe. And World War II was somewhat similar, but with the addition of the Japanese front, the Far East. But in World War III, every country is fighting every country in different ways. And it's not a replica of World War II in the sense that there's not bombs blowing up all over the place, and because there's many forms of warfare, as I'll get into. So I'm going to give five examples, starting with the easier one, going to the more complicated, all within 5 minutes. So the first way to look at it, and I like to color code our enemies and ourselves, is the reds and the greens, namely the communists and the Islamists, have declared war on us, and I call us yellow for the sunlight of Western civilization, which is a combination of secular law, constitution, with religious law, Old and New Testament. You put it, marry them all together, so to speak, you have Western civilization, which is just a fancy word for democracy. So the reds and greens have declared war on the yellows. So that's the easiest way to look at it. Let's go to the next slightly more complicated way to look at it. The holding up Western civilization are three philosophies. Judeo, 3,800 years from the Old Testament. Christian, 2,000 years from the New Testament. And the Constitution Bill of Rights, roughly 250 years. And the Constitution Bill of Rights were derived from the Old and New Testament. So what are the Reds and the Greens doing? They're attacking all three elements of our philosophy, our way of life. They're attacking Judeo, they're attacking Christian, they're attacking Constitution. An attack on any one of the three is an attack on the other two. If you could pretend that we're Siamese twins with three heads, we have a Judeo head, a Christian head, and a secular head. So attack on any one of those heads is an attack on the full body of Western civilization. So let's go to the, now I'll go to the third, slightly more complicated way to look at it. In this format, there's now four enemies of Western civilization. Am I adding the blues? The blues are the globalists, color-coded blue for the United Nations color. But it also includes many corporations, Facebook, Twitter, Google, among others, who are suppressing freedom of speech. And therefore, they don't respect the Constitution Bill of Rights. And they're basically abiding by Chinese rules because they want to grow in China. China's a great growth market. And therefore, they're willing to abide by Chinese rules and forget about American rules. So in this example, there's three enemies, the reds, the greens, and the blues, but there's a fourth. The fourth is the whites, color-coded white for the surrender flag. These people, also known as isolationists, are not evil. They're just normal people living in normal houses, having normal jobs, trying to pay normal mortgage payments and auto payments, send their kids to school, put clothes on the kids, go to the theater every once in a while. And when you talk to them about Afghanistan, Ukraine, Iran, and Taiwan, they don't want to hear about it. Not because they're evil. They're good people. They just think that they can sit in their house and the reds, the greens, and the blues won't attack them. Well, the problem is the reds and the greens and the blues are unrelenting in their attack. Let me go to the final page, the most complicated way to look at it. The reds and greens and blues can be divided into subsegments of particular bad guys. And I've identified 17 bad guys and six forms of warfare, physical, cultural, economic, legal, demographic, and cyber. When you multiply 17 bad guys and six forms of warfare, it's about 100 fronts, but not every bad guy uses every form of warfare. So it comes out to about 90 forms of warfare, and that's what we're fighting.
5 minutes on the nose. Thank you. A remarkable feat, and I think a very accurate portrayal of both the dynamics that are at work here and the complexities. So now I'm going to ask you to do this elevator speech in 2 minutes. Give us the highlights of what you've just described, and what, if I were a United States senator, you would be trying to impress upon me most.
Okay, so in 2 minutes, I'm going to tell you everything that's wrong in the world and how to fix it. Number one, we're in World War III, whether we want to be or not. The reds and the greens and the blues, which I will define in 1 second, have declared war on the yellow. So now let me define the color code. Yellow is we the people, are a yellow for the sunlight of Western civilization. We believe in the Constitution Bill of Rights. We believe in the Old and New Testaments. When you marry them all together, you have democracy, which we call Western civilization. Approximately half of the world lives in a democracy. The democracy is not functioning very well, but in a theoretical democracy, you will find half the people. The other half of the people live in an authoritarian or dictatorship, and those would be the reds, greens, and the blues are everywhere. So let me explain the reds and the greens. The reds are the communists, which would be China, Russia, former communists, North Korea, and the greens would be the Islamists, Iran in particular, but also the Muslim Brotherhood financed by Turkey and Qatar, and Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and hundreds of affiliates around the world. The blues are everywhere. They're the United Nations, they're plus United Nations organizations, WHO, International Criminal Court, plus corporations like Facebook, Twitter, and Google, who operate on a worldwide basis and have adopted Chinese morality instead of American morality to govern them, because if they don't, they'll be knocked out of China. So they've decided to basically be loyal to China. If you put this mess all together, the United States is fighting a 10-front war for its existence. In 1 minute, I'm going to tell you everything that's wrong in the world and how to fix it. We're fighting World War III. We're under attack from multiple sides. A simple way to look at it is we, the people, which I call the yellows for the sunlight of Western civilization, we're in the middle, and we're surrounded by three enemies. The reds, the greens, and the blues. The reds are the communists, the greens are the Islamists, the blues are the globalists. Now, one of the challenges is when I say communists, immediately people say, oh, China, okay, or Islamists, Iran, or globalists, United Nations. Everyone thinks that they're somewhere else. Half of the enemies are within the country. So we're fighting as opposed to World War II, where most of the 99% of the activity was over there. We're fighting here against worldwide criminal organizations, basically, the reds, the greens, and the blues. If you put it all together, I've identified 90 different fronts or issues or challenges. We have to learn how to manage 90 issues simultaneously.
Ken Abramowitz, I want to just again thank you for both the hard intellectual work that's gone into putting this together in a way that's, you know, accessible to people, and for the work that you've done, hundreds of speeches or presentations or briefings with many members of Congress and others, year after year after year, just as a public citizen committed to saving our country and with a particular grasp of what it has to be saved from and how to do it. I want to talk a little bit more about the how to do it part, because that didn't always get into the mix here. Obviously, it starts with understanding the nature of the enemy. And I'm appreciative that you've shared that with us. But let's just say you've got communists, you've got Islamists, you've got universalists, globalists, the United Nations and its friends, whatever you want to call them, great resetters, aided and abetted to some extent by isolationists. What is the 1 or 2 minute version of what specifically we should be doing in the face of this combination of adversaries, as you say, both abroad?
Well, it's not that much more complicated than a football game. In a football game, what percentage of the team's time is spent on offense versus defense? In round numbers, it's 50-50. And if it's ever 65-35, you're going to win the game if you're spending 65% of time on offense. If you look at the bad guys, the reds, the greens, and the blues, they play offense 100% of the time. If you look at the good guys, the yellows, we the people, we play defense 100% of the time.
If we're playing at all. Sometimes we're thinking we're in the stands. And there's no game here other than the one they're watching over there.
That's right. Yeah. Well, you have to assume that we know we're in World War III, which we don't know.
Right.
But you're right. But assuming we're fighting, we play defense 100% of the time. The bad guys play offense 100% of the time. So the number one way to fix it is by coming up with the profound analysis that we should be playing offense at least 50% of the time.
It's a brilliant insight. And if we were only doing that, you know, you may be winning 50% of the time,
right,
which isn't really ideal, but at least you'd be in the fight. So give us some specific suggestions as to what that fighting on offense particularly looks like. Are you talking about kinetic fighting? Are you talking about actual warfare? Are you talking about, well, the kinds of things that the Chinese Communist Party has called unrestricted warfare against us? They're using it all the time.
Well, I'm very appreciative to the bad guys because they teach me. And so the unrestricted warfare was very insightful, which is you can think of it in a boxing analogy. If you play normal boxing and you show up like this and the other guy starts kicking you, and you go, wait a minute, that's not in the rules. He goes, there aren't any rules. You go, I thought there were rules. So we basically have to fight with all tools available. We can't just fight according to the rules. If they're not playing by the rules, we're not going to fight by them. So there's 6 forms of warfare that I monitor. Physical war, which is what everybody thinks about as warfare. But I also include COVID, which is part of physical war, which was biological warfare by China against the U.S., also, when China ships fentanyl to Mexico and then over the border, that would be chemical or drug, illicit drug warfare. And
killing 100,000 Americans
yes,
a year.
Yes, right. Very, very serious. No discussion about it.
Right.
They just, oh, isn't that terrible that Johnny died?
Well, they promised to stop it, of course.
Yes, right. By the way, in Israel, arson is a form of physical warfare. I also monitor cultural warfare, where you just fight with words. I hate you, you're stupid, you're racist. Number three.
And I won't let you talk.
That's right. Right. After I say what I'm going to say, I'm going to silence you.
Right.
Okay? And then we can fight with economics, with dollars. I'm going to boycott you. Number four, we can fight with lawyers. I'm going to sue you. Number five, we can fight with demographics. What's going on the southern border is demographic warfare by the federal government against the American people. And I can fight with cyber. So if we're going to win, we have to fight on all six forms of warfare.
Because the enemy is using all six of those against us.
That's right.
And increasingly seems prepared to use kinetic means against us as well. How does that fit into the dynamic that you've just been talking about? And not least, is our inaction, our passivity, our playing defense, if at all, conducing into incentives for them to become ever more aggressive and indeed violent?
Yes. So again, with the help of the Chinese, the objective is to fight wars in the five other forms of warfare so you don't have to fight the kinetic. To fight the kinetic war means you failed or you didn't do your job in the five non-kinetic forms of warfare. World War II would be a graphic example. We didn't do our job, so to speak, intimidating or disabling the Japanese and the Germans, and we ended up with a big war and 60 million dead people. Properly managed, we wouldn't have anything close to 60 million dead people, but we mismanaged the situation and got 60 million. I don't want World War III to be a repeat of that, where we fail at the five forms of non-kinetic warfare, then get into the kinetic and have another 60 or more million people dead for no reason.
Winston Churchill called World War II the unnecessary war. I think what you're talking about is every bit as much. If we can take the sorts of steps that you're talking about, perhaps we can spare our children and our children's children the consequences of this. When you look at the universe of people making decisions about our policies, is there anybody in all of those hundreds of elected officials at various levels, governors, you know, congressmen, city councilmen? I know you're absolutely Catholic, small c, in your efforts to spread this word. Have you found many people who resonate to this? First of all, many that have understood it before you actually started briefing them, or at least got it once you were finished.
Well, if you look at the different powers within the country, you have the administration, of course, you have the House, you have the Senate, you have the governors, you have attorney generals. Let's just look at those five elements. The best hope is in the governors and attorney generals of the Republican states. Roughly 27 states are run by Republicans, and they understand it not all equally, but they understand the mess, and they're basically going to have to manage their state as if there's no federal government, because the federal government is out of control, lawless. So if a state...
And playing for the other team in a number of instances, as you say, with the border, most especially.
Yes. So number one, the governors and the attorney generals have to step up. I mean, like 5 or 10 times more than they do right now to basically manage their states according to the Constitution, which we all believe in.
States' rights.
Yes, yes. Which we've forgotten over the years. As you know, in the beginning days, the states had all the rights, and they reluctantly gave some of these rights to the federal government. Now the federal government has taken more and more rights away from the states, and we have to reverse that trend, but it's up to the governors and the attorney generals to do that. The next stage we come to are the senators and the congressmen. The senators and the congressmen, I speak to about 100 of them a year, and either on the phone or in person, and only the top 10% of the class understand the mess we're in. The others are very nice people, very hardworking, very sincere, very focused on their district or their state, but they don't see the bigger picture surrounding them, and they need help. And they can be helped, and they can learn, and they can improve. As a final point, the administration, there's no hope in the administration. There's nobody who understands the gravity of the situation. Nobody understands World War III. Nobody is afraid of them. And I would call them warmongers, so to speak, through their weakness. And so I'm very worried about the administration. And to the extent the administration knows what's going on, some elements within the administration are working for the other team, either the Reds, the Greens, and the Blues. And you add,
or all of the above.
Or all of the above, yeah. Yes.
Against the United States of America.
Yes.
It's shocking.
Yes.
Ken Abramowitz, this education that you're providing, it seems to me, has never been more needed. For a reason, and I feel it very strongly in my own experience trying to teach people about these subjects. And I wonder if you'd agree with this analogy. You've spent much of your professional life brilliantly, I might add, in the healthcare business, making money in hedge funds and investing on it and so on. You understand, probably better than just about anybody, I think, this analogy. And that is that we have, in the past 30, 40, maybe years, genetically modified the body politic of the United States to mutate, beyond recognition, really, one of the most fundamental parts of our DNA in the body politic sense of the word, namely the survival instinct. The just plain common sense that enables people to make rational decisions about what will conduce to their safety, which they should adopt as their preferred course of action, as opposed to the behavior that is going to get them killed. You're trying, it seems to me, to do a little, if I can use this expression, gene therapy to get that survival instinct resuscitated, re-implanted, whatever you want to call it. Am I right? Is that where we find ourselves now, that we've gotten so far removed from maybe just the circumstance in which life is so dangerous day to day that we can safely ignore these circumstances, and you're trying to make sure people appreciate just how dangerous it is?
Well, one of the problems we have is our enemies are human beings. If they were lions, tigers, and bears, to quote Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, then people say, oh, the Reds are lions, and there's tigers, and there's bears.
And they're hungry.
Yeah.
And they're going to eat me.
OMG, we have to do something here. But because they're humans, and they can be wearing a tie and sort of look like us. And
we impute to them the same values that we have,
right,
and likely the same behavior.
Right. And they can speak in falsehoods, but we believe them because Americans are very forgiving people. We expect people to tell the truth. So it's very easy for us to be disarmed, and it's up to our leaders to identify the lions, tigers, and bears. Unfortunately, our leaders are in bed, so to speak, with the lions, tigers, and bears, and therefore confusing the American public. But I know how to fix it.
In 1 minute, tell us how to fix it.
Well, I have a real way and a joke. The joke is the only issue I and Nancy Pelosi agree on is that 50% of the country needs to be in re-education camp. That's the joke. We disagree, of course, who should be. But the real answer is we have to get control over the educational system. Two separate issues, K-12 and the universities. And it's very easily fixable. We have to go to universal school choice. So, and we need a student bill of rights. So students will have the right to have teachers who believe in the Constitution Bill of Rights. We'll have the right to read American books, not foreign books. We'll have the right to read books that are loyal to the Constitution Bill of Rights. So if you combine school choice with a student bill of rights, that can fit, and vouchers. School choice goes hand in hand with vouchers. That's how to fix K-12. On the university level, I would just announce that the universities have become political organizations and therefore have lost their tax-exempt status starting this afternoon. And if they want to get it back, here's 10 things they have to do. As soon as they do the 10 things and become educational organizations again, they get the tax incentives, deductions back as soon as possible.
Let me just say, a characteristically both brilliant and simple idea. Mm-hmm. And I commend you for it, Ken Abramowitz, and I thank you so much for sharing all of these insights and ideas with our Secure Freedom Radio audience. And I hope you'll come back, because I want to talk with you about that curriculum that is actually being used to teach our kids these days, including critical race theory and hating America. That's for another day. Thank you for your time on this one.
Pleasure to be with you.
You again soon.
Anytime. Thank you.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to a friend of many years, though we've not been in touch for a frightfully long time. His name is Thomas Gipping. He is a senior legal fellow for the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He has been there, off and on for some time, but he has been there most recently following his service with now retired United States Senator Orrin Hatch, in which capacity he worked as a chief counsel for him on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Tom is a man of considerable expertise on matters involving the judiciary and the public policy issues that are often very much the work of the judicial branch of our government. And we wanted to catch up with him in particular about the departure from the Supreme Court of Justice Stephen Breyer at the end of this term, and the implications of, well, among other things, President Biden's announced decision to consider only Black women to replace this distinguished jurist. Tom, it is great to catch up with you again. I'm sorry that it's been so long, but welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's a delight to have a chance to visit with you about a number of issues that are before this particular court and others at the moment.
Thanks, Frank. It's great, great to be with you.
You have, of course, been following the business of confirming Supreme Court justices in your role on the Judiciary Committee, seen a few of those fights close at hand and been involved in them yourself, needless to say. Give us your sense as to this particular confirmation process. We don't yet know who will be nominated to fill this position, but we're already understanding, you know, people who won't be considered, and I'm interested in your thoughts on the implications of such an approach.
Well, this is taking place against the backdrop of the conflict between two very different views of how much power judges are supposed to have in our system of government. The traditional view, the founders' view, which the Republican Party tends to lean toward, is a much more modest, less political view of judicial power. The left, which the Democrat Party has completely embraced, it views it as a very political branch. And so that flavors the processes when there's a Supreme Court vacancy and Democratic presidents or Republican presidents are in office. So for that reason, I think the attacks on Republican nominees from the left have been much more intense, much more, gloves off than when a Democratic president nominates someone and Republicans are in the majority. So I think what we're going to see today with the Breyer vacancy, I think there'll be a vigorous debate about how much power the Supreme Court should have. Should the Supreme Court control the Constitution or vice versa? But I don't expect to see, you know, the kinds of attacks that we saw against Brett Kavanaugh, against Amy Coney Barrett. You know, you're not going to see people zeroing in on what her religious beliefs are and all this kind of thing. As to your question of the selection process, you know, Joe Biden promised 2 years ago that he would appoint a Black woman. This was during the presidential campaign. People need to know, though, he did that in February of 2020, just a couple of days before the South Carolina primary. And he did it because the most powerful Democrat in South Carolina, Representative James Clyburn, told him to. And having done so, Clyburn endorsed him and delivered South Carolina for Biden. So it's not just, I don't think, at least in this instance, kind of the really unfortunate and exclusionary quota-oriented approach to just consider black women. But he's delivering on a campaign promise. And I think that that is smarmier. It smacks of sort of pay for play. And it gives it, I think, an even more negative connotation as to what he's doing.
I couldn't agree more with that. Tom, it is again against the backdrop of a lot of criticism of a hyper-politicized court. In fact, the whole idea that there are now, at least nominally, six conservative-leaning justices is cited by the left as grounds for having to expand the number of people that will serve on the Supreme Court so that, to use the old FDR phrase, the court can be packed with people who are of a different political persuasion, that of the left. This would seem, though, to be a prime example of such politicization of the court, as you say, if basically what Biden is simply doing is putting aside the question of merit or quality of candidates in favor of identity politics, full stop.
Sure. Well, you're seeing kind of a dragging the institution of the judiciary down further into the sort of ordinary political muck, if you will. For most of our history, it wasn't that way. The judiciary was considered, it's certainly one of the three branches, but it was considered because it was supposed to be separate from that largely. It was, you know, for as long as pollsters were asking questions, that by far the most respected of the institutions of government. And now, you know, two polls in the last few months have said that more than 60% of Americans think that the Supreme Court decides cases based on politics instead of the law. That's a very dangerous place to be with regard to the judicial branch. And actions by President Biden and calls by the left to, you know, if we don't have a court that gives us what we want, let's create a different one, only contribute to that degradation, I think, of an independent judiciary, which, frankly, is the envy of every other judiciary in the world, and is the distinction between something remotely called the rule of law and nothing but power politics. So these developments are really harming the country, quite apart from whether an individual nominee, you know, is sort of technically qualified. The way the president is going about this, I think, is reckless and is really harms the country.
Tom, he commissioned a committee, I guess, to evaluate the way forward with the court, which did not, I think, somewhat to my surprise, come down squarely on the side of, you know, packing the court. That seemed to be pretty much what its charter was intended to be. What did you make of the commission and its findings? And where do you think, if at all, they're going to have an impact in the future?
Well, and to clarify, you know, just what court packing is, because that too has been a subject of some confusion. Court packing is expanding the size. Let's just focus on the Supreme Court, expanding the number of seats on the Supreme Court, not because the court needs more judges, but in order to change its decisions, for the current president to quickly fill those, and then they can start making decisions to push the court in a different direction. That was the plan that everyone, including Democrats, rejected in 1937 when FDR proposed it, and when some of Thomas Jefferson's supporters proposed it in 1801, it was rejected as well. To his credit, and a stop clock is right twice a day, to his credit, Joe Biden opposed court packing when he was a senator, and he opposed court packing while he was running for president. He said so in several candidate debates, and the left kept pushing him in that direction, or trying to. So shortly before the election in 2020, he gave an interview where he said he would appoint a commission to study Supreme Court reform. And he actually indicated that it was not going to be primarily about court packing, although people expected that that would be the dominant subject. He did a few things, I think, to set up that commission to not endorse court packing. He put 36 members on it, which, you know, most of whom were lawyers. You can't get two lawyers to agree on three things, but and 32 of them were law professors, right? So, you know, other than 10,000 footnotes, you're not necessarily going to get much agreement. He did not ask the commission to make recommendations. I put out a paper that Heritage published last year looking at dozens of presidential commissions, including court reform commissions. Every one of them identified a specific problem that needed attention and specifically asked for recommendations. Biden did not do either of those. I think that was intentional. I think that was so that this quote court reform commission would do stuff, but not come up with any definitive position. It certainly did not support or endorse court packing. And I'm very glad for that. I can't think of a bigger direct assault on the independence of the judicial branch than the political branches deliberately trying to manipulate it in order to change its decision. So, you know, Biden checked the box, although I don't think he fooled the far left of his party. They weren't satisfied. They will not be satisfied until the Supreme Court cowers before their political agenda. But to his credit, I think he set it up so that we did not get an endorsement of trashing judicial independence.
Well, that's a good thing. I think it's fair to say, and hopefully it will stave off further pressure of this kind to essentially make the court not only in practice, but in the makeup and the composition of it that will be more and more politicized in the future. Tom, it brings us to a particular topic that I think you have been, again, involved in for as long as I've known you and have written about recently at heritage.org. One of the cases before the court, which seems to be disposed to change the existing precedent is with respect to abortion, so-called Roe v. Wade decision. Give us just a quick sense of where the court stands on that matter and why this is so important, both for the court and for the country.
Well, of course, the Supreme Court decided in 1973, Roe versus Wade, as you referred to, that the Constitution protects a right to abortion. I think significantly, no one defends Roe versus Wade as a correct interpretation of the Constitution. No one. And that was true from the very beginning, including scholars who admit that they support the result of Roe versus Wade. Roe versus Wade is an abomination. It is probably among a very short list of the worst decisions the Supreme Court has ever rendered, not just because of its result, but because it did not even attempt to interpret the Constitution. It simply said, this is the way we want it to be. And the country and the courts have struggled with it for 50 years, trying to decide whether to get rid of it, try to save it, try to whatever. The case before the Supreme Court right now is out of Mississippi. Mississippi passed a law prohibiting most abortions after 15 weeks, which is earlier than the Supreme Court said you could ban abortion. And so it presents the court with an opportunity to finally say, we were wrong. This is Roe versus Wade has had a corrosive effect on the law and on the country. The cost of keeping this thing on the books is just too high. And I hope that's what they do. I hope that, you know, that certainly won't settle the abortion issue. It certainly won't, from a pro-life perspective, ban abortion. States are going to have to do that on their own. But states and the people who live in the states will be able finally to make those decisions for themselves. We will no longer have a majority of justices on the Supreme Court tell us what we have to do when the Constitution doesn't. So that's the key, I think. The Supreme Court isn't supposed to make things up. They're not supposed to commandeer the Constitution in order to make the country be what they want it to be. And so it, apart from the abortion issue, it's a very important issue of self.
And as you say, in from the very opening comment, Tom, it's a question of the character of the role of the court and whether it it helps apply the Constitution or whether it rewrites it or controls it, as I think you put it, or simply negates it altogether.
Yeah, and I think just to finish that thought, it's the choice has always been between, and this is true of all of government, not just the courts, but I think especially the courts, the choice has always been the power of the courts versus whether you like what they do. In other words, if you believe that federal courts, unelected judges, should have a modest role in our system, you know, does that change when you want it to, or is that true across the board, whether you like or dislike what you do? You know, it's not. It's only a principle if you apply it to yourself. Otherwise, it's politics. So that choice was there in the beginning, and it's still here now.
One way that the court can be altered, without packing and with profound impact on perhaps the constitutional role played by the court, is if the left can succeed in a current effort. It's not the first time they've tried this, but it's much in evidence at the moment, to induce, compel, Hector or otherwise prevail upon Justice Clarence Thomas to recuse himself on matters that his wife, Ginny Thomas, a prominent conservative activist we both know well, has been involved in one form or another. And I just wonder what your thoughts are, Tom, on this question of recusal. It is under the court's rules, up to the justice in question. And some have recused, including Clarence Thomas in the past. But what's your take on this campaign at the moment, first of all, but also secondly, the impact that it could have if successful?
Well, the campaign isn't new. The left has gone after Ginny Thomas, Clarence Thomas in various ways for many years. It's a little bit, I think, unusual for the left to say that a woman has to be evaluated in light of what her husband does. That's a little bit strange coming from feminists, I suppose. But I think when judges decide whether to recuse themselves, it's usually a pretty objective standard, and it's usually related to a specific case that is before them. It's not whether a relative of theirs or a spouse of theirs has expressed opinions about the subject matter or blah, blah, blah. It can't be that. If it were, you could make connections to any justice on any case that would counsel them to bail out. I think of Judge Stephen Reinhardt on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. His wife was the executive director of the ACLU of Southern California for 30 of his years on the Ninth Circuit. Her organization actually litigated before him. No one ever said that he ought to recuse himself about anything. I can certainly see where the left doesn't like Justice Thomas because they don't like the Constitution. They don't like his approach to taking the Constitution and its original meaning seriously. They'll try to do anything to get that kind of a voice out of the conversation on any particular case. Let's face it, they have lots of strategies for censoring views that they don't like these days. But to attack Jenny and her views it's not only unfair, it's just wrong on the facts. I mean, she's been involved in causes that she cares deeply about for many, many years. And Justice Thomas will assess whether he can be impartial in any individual case, just like every judge does in every case.
Let me just say, Tom, I not only know Jenny, but have worked with her closely. In fact, have seen her go to great lengths to try to make clear that she was not interested in influencing the court or otherwise acting improperly. And I think, to her credit, has done so consistently. I did want to ask you about amicus briefs, because our organization, the Center for Security Policy, filed one with the court in connection with President Trump's decision not to have people from countries, some of which were not only Muslim majority, but Sharia adherent, but some were not. All of them countries that we could not safely assure were sending immigrants here who would not be threatening to our country. A very sensible executive order, and our amicus brief, which was written by brilliant general counsel of the center, David Yerushalmi, and his colleague, I believe, Rob Muse, held forth that, you know, we have a very necessary right to exclude people who embrace, in particular, this Islamic doctrine of Sharia. We call them Sharia supremacists, and seek to force our country to submit to it one way or the other, through violent means or subversion or others. Jenny Thomas, I will say, while she was working with us on other matters, had nothing to do with that amicus brief. But I just ask you, Tom, what are the role of these amicus briefs? Conservative groups, as well as leftist ones, have been filing them for many, many years, as you know. Does that constitute the kind of basis for compelling recusal in a situation like this, would you say?
No, and it's because amicus curiae means friend of the court. These are briefs that are filed by third parties, that is, not the parties to a case itself, offering perspective, information, analysis, whatever. As you know, you have to get the permission of the parties to file such a brief. And, you know, judges don't have to pay any attention to them if they don't want to. They're not the
part. They often don't, well, as I can tell.
You know, it's hard to tell one way or another sometimes, but they certainly don't have to. And they're not the party. They're not the briefs of the parties themselves, so that the status of the legal arguments, I think, is different. But the fact that someone has an opinion, that someone offers a view to the Supreme Court that they do not have to pay attention to, I cannot imagine what argument would suggest that that is that somehow rises to the level that that justice literally has to bow out of a case. I think that's ridiculous.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Tom, there's much more to talk with you about, including the filibuster in the Senate and whether it will continue to enable the minority to have a voice in the work of the Senate. I think that's necessary. I think you do too. And I look forward, if we may, to darken your door again soon to discuss that. And of course, to take further stock of what comes of this Breyer vacancy and President Biden's decisions about how to fill it. I thank you for your time today, my friend, and for the opportunity to reconnect with you again after far too long a time. But thanks for what you're doing at the Heritage Foundation these days and for shedding light on all of this with us today.
Absolutely. I'd love to talk further about all of these things. Thanks for paying attention to these really important issues.
We must indeed. Thanks to the rest of you for paying attention to these issues as well. We look forward to you doing so again tomorrow with us. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Remarkably, as Black History Month gets underway, the man who is arguably the most powerful Black American, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, having served with distinction in that role for 30 years, is being aggressively denigrated by the left. Its operatives transparently seek to discredit and otherwise diminish a man for being a principled and impactful conservative. The present campaign does so by vilifying Justice Thomas's wife, Ginny, another principled conservative whom I am privileged to call a valued colleague. Leftist partisans in the media and their allies want to negate both Mrs. Thomas's effective public policy activism and the justice's vote by dictating when he must recuse himself from cases before the court. Both Clarence and Ginny Thomas have exhibited immense courage, integrity, and independent thought over the years. They deserve our nation's thanks, not the left's scurrilous attacks. This is Frank Gaffney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a break on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
$5 was all she was paid by the Atlantic Monthly magazine for her poem, The Battle Hymn of the Republic, which was published this day, February 1st, 1862. The Union's theme song during the Civil War, Julia Ward Howe wrote it while visiting Washington, D.C., and seeing it teem with military galloping horses and innumerable campfires. Sleeping unsoundly one night, Julia Ward Howe penned, "In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea, with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, while God is marching on."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.